The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Nick Dunn is a professor of urban design at Lancaster University. He is formerly of the Manchester School of Architecture, where he was principal lecturer. His book, Dark Matters, A Manifesto of the Nocturnal City, published by Zero Books last November, explores the city at night as a place and time within which escape from the confines of the daytime is possible. Nicholas Diaz of Net Gallery described the book this way. Dark Matters is a must-read for anyone who's starting with hauntology, derive, or urbanism in general. It's short, urgent, and written with poetic sensitivity. It's Wednesday, May 17th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that Angela Nagel's book, Kill All Normies, along with Brian Willem's novel, Henry Henry, is available for pre-order through Amazon. Henry Henry is an experimental novel comprising two alternating stories. One, a factually inaccurate pseudo-biography of 17th century composer Henry Purcell, and the other, the story of Purcell's mid-20th century biographers. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. The Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with our authors and others. The music you're listening to is After Sunset, performed in 1915 by the Edison Concert Band. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Nick Dunn discuss Dark Matters. Nick Dunn is a professor of urban design at Lancaster University. He is the co-author of the book Urban Maps, Instruments of Narrative and Interpretation in the City, and the author of Dark Matters, A Manifesto for the Nocturnal City, which was published last November by Zero Books and has been doing quite well. It's been reviewed all over the place. And Professor Nick Dunn, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks very much, Doug. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, so just to start with, your book is entitled Dark Matters, A Manifesto for the Nocturnal City. Tell me what Dark Matters refers to, and more than that, why does the nocturnal city require a manifesto of its own, apart from, say, a manifesto you might write for the city as a whole or without specifying a time of day?
Sure. Well, it's a great question. I think the dark matters bit is a bit of a play on words. And for me, it kind of has three meanings. So I suppose in the first instance, you could quite literally think of dark matters. So dark materials or unseen things like we have out there in outer space. So sort of being the kind of glue that maybe holds us together in some way. So there's something about a structure that's maybe unseen or not readily visible to the naked eye, but has some kind of influence on what's going on and the things that we do know about. So that was kind of one meaning. I suppose the second is quite literally, you know, the dark matters, i.e. it's important. It's, you know, as opposed to maybe light in a simple relationship, you know, this is something we ought to have a concern about. There's issues there, and perhaps to problematize it or have a discussion about it would be a worthwhile thing. And more recently, I mean, when I first thought about that title, and it's been a popular title for a number of things I know, I've become to think of it perhaps with a third meaning, which might well be that, you know, the dark matters. So actually, in the sense of something perhaps more troubling, perhaps the slightly more nefarious or darker ways in which culture, politics, socioeconomic relationships are being shaped, formed, and transformed through forces and geometries of power that we can't necessarily see. So there's quite a lot going on in those first two words, but of course readers may just take it quite literally, or indeed have a fourth or fifth interpretation of it. As for the subtitle, I trained as an architect, and as you rightly say now, I'm a professor of urban design. There are lots and lots of manifestos for cities, lots. The history of civilization in many ways is kind of a history of cities. So ever since humanity kind of got together in some kind of collective, we've had ideals, utopias, manifestos for how collective life should be, how it should be formed, what our architect should be. But actually, virtually nothing. There's a very, very scarce history on how we should think about the urban night, and how we might actually relate. So for me, I'm a bit of a sucker for a manifesto anyway. I think perhaps we don't have enough of them. I'm careful to say it's a manifesto. It's perhaps not the manifesto, but it was deliberately trying to be slightly provocative and say, look, you know, there's something here quite important. And in terms of the nocturnal city requiring a manifesto of its own, I'm deeply concerned throughout the book, and it's something I explore, that we're losing something quite fundamental, our relationship with the built environment, with our surroundings. And so in a way, it's a plea, it's a kind of rallying cry to bring it into some kind of focus and bring it to people's attention to think about it, maybe not to have an answer for it, but to at least question some of the things that are happening around and within our cities.
So I want to get to that question of what we're losing in terms of our relationship with the built environment. I think it's a key question of your book. But before we do that, I want to ask you a question that maybe you can answer as an urban designer or as an architect. When someone goes about planning a building, say a commercial space, do they tend to take into account the differences between night and day? In other words, do they plan for how their building will be interpreted or used at night? Or do those kinds of distinctions not tend to be looked at?
If the function of the building, say if it's something that's going to be used as a theatre or perhaps something for live performances, gigs, this kind of thing, obviously this kind of thing is taken into account. But generally speaking, the way we plan our cities and consider our buildings, their relationship at night is often not very well considered at all. If at all, it tends to be a remediation device that we do afterwards. It tends to be an afterthought rather than necessarily something that is considered meaningfully. And I mean, you can see that if you look at a lot of the renders, computer generated images, the depictions of new architecture and cities that are being regenerated or built, they're nearly always shown with beautiful blue skies, irrespective of the global context. Quite often a flock of birds flying past, again, may not be native species to the area. So it's not something that is ingrained in us. And I mean, indeed, I can say this now, and I will not be alone. Throughout my architectural training, I cannot think of a single discussion that we had maybe in the studio during our reviews, or even myself with my peers, with my colleagues, about how the thing might look at night or how it might function differently, unless you were deliberately designing something in that way. So I think it's definitely something to do with the way we're educated, and then indeed how we enter the profession and continue.
I suppose maybe the one question you might ask about a building is, in terms of its nocturnal use or access, would just be, how strong a lock are we going to need for the doors?
Well, absolutely. Unfortunately, I mean, we've entered a rather binary situation now in terms of, which is kind of reflected in the developments of building technology. So if we go back sort of 100 years or so ago, you know, there were lots and lots of buildings developed with very rich facades. You know, we have doorways, steps, windowsills, all these kind of things. But through the development of skyscraper technology and high-rise buildings, and also steel construction, it meant that you could have glass curtain walls so that the skin of the building hangs off the structural frame. And, of course, this just means that all those surfaces, all those that depth of character, the shadow play that's possible, of course, it also, as far as building owners are concerned, can engender some unwanted cultures and effects. So people hanging around, loitering, maybe homeless people sleeping in some of these spaces. Now we get much sharper, crisper lines, which is just simply a line of glazing. And so, as you say, it's very obvious whether someone is outside or inside the building because the demarcation between the two, although the material is much lighter and it's transparent, it's much more decisive than it ever was before.
You know, on the one hand, it seems like we've got a binary situation in the city between night and day, basically buildings being used or not used or being locked down. But on the other hand, it seems like the whole notion of a nightlife is an urban notion, and that it's only been since the development of maybe electric light that the nocturnal city would be a subject at all, other than, you know, how to get away from it, or how to, you know, make sure you're getting enough sleep or something like that. Or not even, I guess you wouldn't even need to worry about getting enough sleep necessarily. But am I wrong? Am I thinking here? Is the idea of a nightlife kind of attached to urban spaces, and like, say, New York City, which is a city that never sleeps?
You're certainly right in saying that it exists in terms of the way that we might think about it now, which is perhaps a series of collective actions, people coming together. I mean, people certainly did things before cities, and it didn't just exist in cities. But it's also important to be aware that, you know, when gas lamps were first introduced, even before electric lights, you know, people in London and Paris were horrified because suddenly the darker, murkier corners, and indeed what people might be up to in those corners and the shadowy world, was suddenly exposed, if you like. People were literally illuminated, whereas before they'd been able to go about their way in whatever way that had been. So the electrification has certainly added an intensity. But of course, there are trade-offs, you know. I mean, it is enabled very steadily and rather quickly, actually, over the last sort of 100 years or so, to encourage us to enter a kind of non-stop life world, you know, which capitalism promotes. So, you know, we're recalibrating rather than maybe having two sleeps as we had done traditionally. You know, we now have shifting configurations of kind of sleeping and not sleeping. You know, and we have these different forms of exposure and unprotectedness, and you could even argue perhaps vulnerability in a way.
Chester, just one of England's old, old towns in the gentle grip of time gone by. We're intruders. Today is an intruder that dins its traffic through so much beauty. A longing for the past, the longing for a pace of life that gives the chance to look, to listen, to admire, to learn to love the feel of life. Something that London can bury beneath its clatter. Only a few sad sentimentalists cherish London pride, cherish the sight even of old street lamps made not for a functional age, but for a time when fairy lights were thought of. Just look at these and merge them yourself with parasols and hansom cabs.
The nocturnal, or the notion of the night, is sort of under threat because of the expansion of capital and basically wanting to turn every moment that
exists into a moment where the market dominates, maybe like in the, like in New York, where you can go and get a, I don't know, some rare dish at 4 o'clock in the morning and everything's always open in New York City. On the other hand, though, there is a kind of activity that's not dominated by the market that we're losing that is truly nocturnal.
Yeah, well, I think it's about our attention and our engagement with things. This sort of broad installation of urban streetlights sort of by the 1880s, you know, sort of does two things which are kind of interrelated. I mean, on the one hand, there'd been a lot of concern. Terrible things had happened to some people in the darkness. So it eradicated our fears and perhaps our perceived dangers of nocturnal darkness. But critically, I suppose, as we pass through the 20th century and certainly now into the 21st, it's completely expanded the time frame, and I suppose in that way the profitability of many economic activities. So I guess what I'm interested in is it's not so much there's a problem with cities being 24/7. I mean, you know, New York is a wonderful city. You know, it's a fantastic place to be. And I think to have that choice to be able to maybe go and do these things is a great opportunity, and it should be open to all. I guess the concern I have is that it's some of these strategies and treating the night city just like an extension of the day city rather than something different means that it's actually changing quite literally physiologically who we are. So the idea of us always being on, never being off, always being kind of hyper visible in a way, means we behave and perform in a fairly sort of responsive way rather than an active way in our environment.
That reminds me of sort of a personal story, something I told a friend the other day, actually another podcaster, and he was shocked to hear this about my life, but it's become true, which is that these days when I go to bed, I put my phone down next to me on the bed table, and it is on, and throughout the night I will get buzzed, oh, probably 2 or 3 times a night by someone, either text messaging me, or usually it's a Facebook message or an email, and I suppose I sleep through some of them, but I am woken up at times, and I will actually, even at like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, answer people. This strikes me as something that, this is brand new. I mean, this is brand new. And sometimes I'll leave my computer on, which is in the same room, and, I'll forget to close a tab my computer will just start really loudly pinging me in the night. So I feel as though I've lost, lost a lot of sleep, but I've lost this disconnection. I've lost the notion of time off, like time when I'm not working. Everything's sort of bled together. I'm sort of working and I'm sort of not working all the time.
Sure. Well, look, at the end of the day, you know, we're in 2017, and you've got to stand up for choice, right? So that's your choice, and you choose to do those things.
Right. They're crazy things to do, aren't they? I mean, I'm crazy, right?
But anyway. I find it slightly disconcerting because you are you're not a gadget because you're a human being, you know? You are almost trying to behave like one because in that kind of mode, you're always on standby. So on the one hand, you can convince yourself you're not actually working for some of that time, and that's good. And the realities of your job and the things you do and the relationships that you have in your life may necessitate that certain people do need to get through to you. But there are emergency kind of protocols and pathways you can set up on your device so that if someone really important in your life is getting hold of you, it can spring your smartphone or whatever into action when no one else can get through. So there's ways through that. But this idea of the right to thought and to have the privacy and place, I suppose, and time to give our attention to things in when we want rather than when it's directed is a considerable concern to me. So, you know, I think, I mean, this is why I say, well, look, it might not be about where we do these things. It might be about when. Now, night workers and shift workers might completely disagree with my kind of argument because they go, well, this is just totally impractical for me. But so you when we make these choices, we are acquiescing to a different kind of performance. I mean, I do switch my phone off when I go to sleep. I don't look at it before I go to bed, when indeed I do go to bed. But these things in some ways are an illusion of control. I mean, all my social media, I don't have set up on my phone so that it's I get notifications. And indeed, my work email is not streamed through my phone. So I have to make a choice, albeit a small choice, to log on and look specifically at that thing. I'm not getting these constant digital prompts that, you know, hey, I'm kind of here. You need to look at this. Because once you've directed your attention to it, the eyes struggle to unsee what has been seen, you know. So even if you've looked at something, you think, oh, no. I've got to kind of respond, or I'm going to think about that thing now. Then it's a problem, you know, and I think it's quite a serious problem.
Well, it's not. I'll tell you this, and I'm not trying to make excuses, but this is something that I didn't. I mean, obviously, I do have the ability to make a choice. I could turn my phone all the way off. I could make sure that all the tabs are closed. But for the longest time, I didn't have a smartphone. Once I got one, it sort of just seemed to be kind of preset. Like Facebook would just alert me. I didn't really go out of my way to set that up, you know? And so I found this happening. It seems like it's happening to me rather than something I'm doing. But obviously, clearly, it's something I'm doing. And I know exactly what you're talking about is about not unseeing things. Because if you get a certain kind of message, maybe a work colleague is irritated with you about something and they send you an email and you see it, it sticks with you. If you don't respond to it right away, it sticks with you anyway for hours and hours. Anyway, yeah, it's, but my question here, I'll put a question at the end of this. Does this have to do with, the idea of the nocturnal city? Is this an intrusion into what you would call the nocturnal city? Even though it doesn't necessarily seem to be connected to any kind of particular space. I mean, I can imagine living in a farmhouse and having the same problem, maybe.
In that way, it's about our relationship with technology, and indeed, that which is sort of directly shaping and informing the species we're kind of becoming. And these have advantages, and they have disadvantages. I mean, whether you're in a rural area or an urban area, you know, your relationship with your phone or whatever laptop is your relationship with your technology. And although we can never, ever be sort of shopping and gaming and working and doing all this stuff all the time, I suppose the concern is that there's no moment or place or situation now where perhaps you cannot not do those things. And so my plea, I suppose, in a way, is that the nocturnal city could be somewhere where perhaps collectively, maybe individually to start with, but collectively, people could start to have a place and a time to think differently, away from some of these distractions. Now, this worked for me because, I mean, you know, look, I'm an academic, so you know, as I always joke, the best thing about my job is it's not 9 to 5, and the worst thing about my job is it's not 9 to 5, right? So, you know, I'm always tied up in some ways, and I have a skewed geography and sort of temporal relationship in terms of what I do. But equally, I can zone out, I can switch off, and I can walk away from it. And I think this relationship to our surroundings is and giving our attention to things is harder to do for the majority of people during the day because we're tasked with lots and lots of things. So we may be dropping the kids off at school, we may be going to work, we may be doing the groceries. We generally speaking, in the daylight hours, have more responsibilities than perhaps we do at the night. But of course, it's a generalization. It won't ring true for everyone. So in that case, where is the space and time for respite? Where is the opportunity for us to maybe have, you know, to be able to imagine alternatives? You know, we seem to be stuck in a quite serious inertia, and sort of culturally, socially, in a sort of really quite disarming, but also very worrying period of regurgitation, you know? So styles, tropes are kind of folding in on themselves in either tightest decreasing circles in a way. You know, we're sort of in this Mobius strip now. And you can, I mean, this kind of bears out in politics. I mean, you know that the left, both here in the UK and I guess in the US, but I'm less familiar with your context, is just not able to assemble itself. You know, people just have no time to imagine a reasonable opposition or think differently about the world. And I think that's very, very worrying.
And you think that the loss of this nocturnal city or this loss of the dark matter, a time where the phone is not just off because we've chosen for it to be off, but where the phone is like inaccessible, it's you know, it just isn't functioning, that because we've lost that, we are losing some creativity, we're losing some ability to be independent thinkers or to think more imaginatively.
If we're not careful, we could be promoting a kind of new wave of Luddite behavior, and I'm absolutely not for that, right? Okay, so I'm talking to you via my laptop, my smartphone, who sat next to me, okay? I'm not in a cave over in Manchester, you know, trying to collect the cosmic signals via some twigs and leaves. So I understand the realities and practicalities of every day. However, this quite superficial series of connections in many ways, I mean, the internet and social media can be very enlightening in some ways, but it can also be very, very superficial. It can distract us and certainly pull us away from being able to think more imaginatively about what we might do, how we might act, what we might behave, what kind of alternative future might we want, and what kind of social relationships might we want in that. So it's not that they are mutually exclusive. I mean, technology will be a part of this, I'm sure. And again, it comes down to personal choice. It's not a doctrine. But I myself found that actually having a break from that to some extent was very, very useful. I mean, these technologies are doing strange things to us. I mean, we, you know, there's been some scientific sort of research into the fact that when we like things or we respond to emails and things like this, we kind of get the same kind of chemicals released in our brain. You know, it makes us feel good. It's a good thing to do. But it's a bit like eating fast food. It's a bit of a short-term thing rather than a long-term nourishment for the human condition.
This is Georges Seurat's first painting of nighttime entertainment, a theme that he continued to paint the rest of his short life. This was a parade, or circus sideshow, was a way of getting people to come into the circus, like roll up, come in through the door. We know he's evoking gaslight in a nighttime setting, but what light did he intend the picture to be viewed under? We're going to try to simulate the effect of gaslight and see what it does to the painting. What we're seeing now is the painting the way we normally see it every day in a gallery light. We are going to gradually lower the lights. We're going to create a warmer color temperature. And we know that gaslight had a slight flicker to it. And so something that we were interested in adding onto this effect was to see what a flicker would do. And I think you may see that it's really very different. It's very exciting. We're seeing a great deal more contrast in the painting. And all the illumination in the painting is enhanced. The yellow of the trombone is much more pronounced. The glow that's coming through from the illuminated tent inside is warmer and more alluring. And there's just a feel of greater depth and mystery about the picture under gaslight.
Well, now in your book, you talk about wandering the city at night. I was reminded of the Situationist International and their practice of the derive. Was that an influence on your practice of wandering the city at night?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's definitely in there, but it's I think this again speaks perhaps of just how lacking in our imagination we are. That if artists, urban walkers, geographers, other people are out walking in the city in a fairly indeterminate way, we always readily associate it with the Situationist practice, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's a kind of shorthand, and the cadaver of the kind of Situationist gets regularly exhumed. But there's a lot of problems with what the Situationists were doing. I mean, Guy Debord was obviously a bit fanatical in some ways, and certainly quite restrictive in terms of the influence of the other members. I mean, in terms of its control, and I think it also suggests, and some more recent books, you know, on urban walking and relate to psychogeography. I suppose my reservations about some of these things is they suggest there's a right way to do it. And if there's a right way to do it, then that suggests possibly the role of an expert or perhaps something that's not accessible to many, many people. And I'm very keen to completely debunk that. I think that's ridiculous. You know, we're just talking about going out for a walk. So if people have a form of mobility, you know, I mean, I realize this isn't necessarily possible for everyone, but people will get different things from it. And your town, your city, your suburb, wherever you may be, you will see it very, very differently if you experience it at night. Now, of course, some cities are very much predicated on private automobile ownership, and they're not built for humans. They don't readily lend themselves to being walking environments. And that can be a challenge. I mean, I found it very difficult to walk in LA, to be honest, in the past. But I suppose I'm very keen to really promote the idea to lots of people to just try it. And this doesn't have to be, there's nothing heroic about it. I'm not a naturally brave man. You might do it for half an hour. You might do it for 10 minutes. You might want to do it with a friend, or you might want to take your dog. There's certainly not that you have to work out what works for you, but it's about giving yourself a place and a time to reflect and perhaps just think slightly differently about the world, and then think about what that might mean going forward rather than always responding to something that's external to us in a way.
Well, about... I guess it would have been now 7 years ago. I was unemployed for a little while, and I decided to spend my time doing some urban foraging, which was like going around in my neighborhood and looking for wild blackberries or apple trees or things like that to find fruit. At the time, right after the economic crisis, and there was in the Pacific Northwest, there was a lot of emphasis on kitchen gardens and self-sufficiency and preparing for the apocalypse and all that kind of thing. And I was familiar with the Situationist International, and I decided to wander my neighborhood, and I wrote a little book even about it. In fact, I knew I was going to write a book while I was doing it. And as I wandered, I also was reading quite a lot of theory. I read Henri Lefebvre's The Production of Space and some of the Critique of Everyday Life. And what I found there, especially I remember in the Critique of Everyday Life, there was this notion that the rural space, the country, had an authenticity and a naturalness that was being lost as more and more spaces were under the control of capital and were being produced through capitalist production. And it was odd because I felt in a way that this was backward looking and it was something that I couldn't, also something I couldn't find when I was out wandering, is any sense of, even in like alleys and or areas which were underdeveloped, I didn't feel that I was getting away from the culture of capitalism as I did this wandering. But I wondered, is the idea of a nocturnal city in any way similar to the idea that Henri Lefebvre had about the country? Are we looking for, are we looking for a natural space, a space that's outside of our own produced spaces when we make this move?
I think we could be. I think that's a really interesting point, Doug. I mean, I suppose as we see increasingly in our urban landscapes, the privatization of public space. I mean, Mike Davies, of course, famously wrote in the City of Quartz, you know, 27 years ago, about these kind of strategies that were being put in place to stop even respite, to stop rest. So you famously had the bum-proof bench in LA, you know, that wouldn't let a homeless person even be able to sleep on it because of the way it was shaped. And various cities around the world are deploying this. I mean, in my home city, Manchester, we've had those spikes placed in small inlets on buildings so that previously homeless people have been able to sleep and now they can't. So this kind of militarization, you know, of the city, of urban space, you know, that the city can actually bite back in a way, and not actually let you have a break, is I think part of this in many, many ways. And so it's as we continue to kind of calibrate, measure, classify our space, we're increasingly seeing a situation where any behaviors that are not directly linked to consumerism in some way are often seen as undesirable, as unwelcome in the city. So in that way, we're very much extending what works in the daytime into all forms and all spaces of the nighttime city. And I guess I'm interested in questioning that and actually encouraging other people to question that. And I mean, I very deliberately don't talk about urban exploration and practices that are perhaps in a grey area as part of legality and illegality is concerned, because I wouldn't necessarily encourage readers to do that. But actually, the very fact that we're just walking through a street or a square, depending on how we look, depending on how many of them there are, I mean, sort of here in the UK, we have dispersal zones now. So if there's a number of people walking and they don't look quite right to authorities or assumed authorities, so increasingly we have the control of urban space and public space, as it's misunderstood, being under private security firms, then they can just disperse you. They, you know, so quite innocuous things like leafleting and gathering in small groups can actually be prohibited very, very quickly and very effectively. So the idea that you've got to spend, you know, $4 or $5 on a coffee or a beer or something to be anywhere, I find pretty abhorrent, to be honest.
Right. Yes. So this is something that I discovered when I was wandering my neighborhood and trying to go into areas where I hadn't been, because, you know, if you live and work in a particular area, there are kind of grooves in your neighborhood. There are places where you go, and there's quite a lot of places where you don't go, especially in residential areas. There's no reason for me to go three streets over. I don't know anyone over there. So, like, I realized that I had not walked most of the residential area I was in. But what I discovered was, walking in residential streets, I felt out of place, even during the day. And I think at night it would have been even worse. And that it was only when I was on commercial streets and or around public housing that I felt like I didn't stick out, like I didn't need to make any excuses for loitering or for looking more than once at a building. So it was interesting to realize how much of the space around me was private and how much of it was outside of my domain, that where how much of it I wasn't really welcome in.
Suburbia is certainly a strange place. I mean, it was J.G. Ballard that was pretty convinced the future was going to be played out there. You know, suburbia told us all about the future. And you're right. I mean, this talks about very long-held views that we have with the nighttime, you know, darkness being humanity's longest and most terrible fear in some ways, that a guy simply walking down the street in the daytime may seem slightly uncanny, but the same guy walking down a residential street a few hours later, perhaps, well, he must have intent. He must, you know, it's questionable. Why is he here? We've not seen him before. And I think, in a way, you know, this really amplifies the for all our technological embellishment and all our devices, we've still not managed to let go of some quite fundamental things and relationships with the night that we've had for millennia, in many ways, for centuries. You know, the idea that with the night is brought with it all kind of terrible things. And this isn't necessarily true. So I suppose, although I do talk about walking through some suburbs in the book, I tend to generally encourage walking through more built-up areas that are slightly more intense to sort of perhaps not put readers in that kind of situation. I mean, you have to find what's comfortable for you. But I was struck by how different, and like yourself, I've not had reason to walk around many of the streets and places near where I live, and just how different they were, actually. I mean, of course, it depends on the time of night we're talking as well. And that's the other thing, you know. I mean, there isn't just day and there isn't night, but there's lots and lots of different shades and kind of time spaces within that whole 24-hour cycle, which is quite interesting. And, you know, of course, during the winter, very different again from the daytime. So from the summer, rather, in terms of how long the night is.
In your book, you talk about something called the unofficial countryside. What is that, and is that something that only exists at night, or is it there during the day as well?
The unofficial countryside was actually the title of a book by a gentleman called Richard Mabey, and he was really trying to bring people's attention to, I guess, what you might consider areas of land that perhaps were post-industrial or were on the edge of urban landscapes or neglected, that rather than the very romantic view that we might have of rolling landscapes and natural beauty. So we think maybe about some of the British landscape, or I guess some of the huge national parks in the States, and these kind of this notion of the ideal, the uninterrupted, the pure countryside. He was really bringing people's attention to the weeds, to the things that grew up through bits of building or maybe abandoned parking lots or bits of drain pipe and all this other stuff. So it absolutely exists during the day. I think the difference is, though, that at night, these kind of edgelands, these kind of areas that are sort of semi-abandoned often have a very, very different feeling than they would do during the day when you're in them. So that they feel much more porous, I suppose, in some regard, and have a very kind of, I guess, sort of supernatural quality in a way. You know, they feel quite otherworldly. I mean, the key thing, you know, at night, even when we've got illumination, we're not as reliant on our visual senses. Our other senses kick into play. So our sense of touch, our sense of smell, our sense of hearing. I mean, perhaps not our sense of taste, but, you know, you never know. I wouldn't want to inhibit anybody to go out there and lick buildings at night. But this, and this is really interesting. You know, Richard Sennett's talked about the tactile sterility of contemporary built environments and the fact that we're pretty much inhibited from doing anything. And I think these spaces, this kind of unofficial countryside, can become quite a rich experience to put us back in touch with our surroundings that are quite familiar and quite everyday. We recognize them, but we don't pay much attention to them, I suppose.
Do you know who T.J. Clark is?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
He's an art historian, and he was a member of the Situationist International, but the British sect, basically. And he wrote a book called The Painting of Modern Life about the Impressionists and about Paris and mostly Manet. One of the things I remember, and I wish I could I had the quote like on hand, but I don't. But what I remember, or if I could at least refer to the painting that he's referring to, but I can't. But he wrote about how the Impressionists in Paris after Haussmann were really interested in painting these kinds of spaces that you're talking about, the unofficial countryside, the spaces where Haussmannization stopped, like right these liminal spaces between the old Paris and the new Paris, that this was a major subject within the paintings of the Impressionists, and that there was something about modernity that these spaces spoke to, or that this kind of space defined modernity. And I guess for me, what it defined was this notion of industry and reason and rationality impinging on the old, which was associated with the natural. And is that the kind of space that you're talking about when you talk about the unofficial countryside, the space where you can see the boundary between the rationalized urban planned environment and the less planned rural world of nature?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, yes, I think the short answer would be, I think the longer answer is actually it's the blurry edges. It's the bits where nature breaks through. It breaks up through the asphalt, or it takes root in the crevice of a building, or it starts to emerge. Maybe there's, a small alleyway and you start to get an ecosystem there. So it's to do with how places that we wouldn't naturally think of, as you say, as being beautiful, perhaps because they've had industrial life, manufacturing, production, they've been artificially significantly altered in some way, and yet there is still they are still sort of have elements of the countryside in them. They still have elements of what we might define as rural life. And they kind of, as you say, become quite useful places to reflect on maybe where we are and where we're going, I suppose, in that way.
Right. Do you think there's something fundamentally revolutionary about these spaces, maybe the nocturnal city or the unofficial countryside, that by visiting these places, maybe not in a particular way, but just by setting out to explore these dark matters, that we have the potential for a revolutionary action that we wouldn't have without those spaces, without the willingness to explore them?
I absolutely think there could be. I think we're running out of ideas, and we're running out of time. And what I mean by that is that our ability, seemingly as a species, to think about new things, not remixes of old things, but actually think about new ways, new constructs, new oppositions, new articulated arguments against capitalism, or against sort of certain economic behaviors, or perhaps social injustices, is running out. And this seems to be a problem that's actually getting much worse. So, you think about, I'm reminded here of the writings of Mark Fisher, and particularly his idea of a kind of reflexive impotence. The idea that perhaps his observation that younger generations kind of know how bad things are, and because it's because of that understanding of just what a complex and difficult situation they're in, they're actually unable to do anything about it. I think this is very, very true and very, very timely of where we are. We, human beings need time and a place to be creative and to imagine. And what I see with late capitalism interwoven with all our attendant technological devices is a calibration, a measurement, and an erosion of any time or new ideas to do it, because we're constantly presented with everything all the time. We can access anything. So if I want to listen to a piece of music now, I can just grab it. I can go and listen to it. We're constantly have this very, very delicate membrane between being able to access everything, but weirdly not actually being able to do anything meaningful often with that, because it's just there. So whilst I accept that there are some very useful collaborative tools and ways of engaging with each other through some of these new technologies and online methods, I also believe that it's fundamental to being alive and being human that we have respite from that, so that we can actually think differently and meaningfully about our collective future.